Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Wines of Bordeaux. Visit their website at bordeaux.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, Michael Mecco here. Welcome back. Happy holiday, everybody. This is the first show. I think this is the first week, right, that Heritage is back on air post-Christmas, post-New Year's. Hope everyone had a good holiday. We did. I had some really good wine. My son was home for some of the holidays, and he's really into wine these days. So it's great. We break out the good bottles so that we can stick our noses in them and geek out. That's always fun. Anyway, got a great show. Speaking of wine, we're going to do a lot of wine today. We've got three guests. Victoria James, my first guest, a sommelier, and we're going to talk about this because you've heard me talk about this a lot on the show. So I've never, this is the first time we've met in the interest of full disclosure. So hello, nice
hello.
To meet you.
You as well.
I tried to get in the restaurant, but I could not this week. My schedule was too crazy, and I tried to juggle and squeeze. Just get in there last night, and it wasn't going to happen. But your ears might have been buzzing or whatever that expression is because my last show before the break, Patrick Capiello was here. And we were talking specifically because he's kind of like the Pied Piper of this generation of Somme because he's like the cool older guy. Not that he's older. He's like 42. But he's right. He just reeks coolness. He's tall. He's skinny. He's got the big geeky glasses. Yeah. Almost always the Converse high tops, the skinny jeans, some kind of raggedy t-shirt, right?
Super way cooler than me, for sure.
Way cooler. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, he did like a sequence like right before New Year's Eve on like one of those national morning TV shows where he was sabering champagne on the air.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, with like cool. That with that outfit on. But instead of wearing like a goofy t-shirt, he had like a flannel shirt on. But that's like that's him in a tux, basically.
Right, yeah.
But I was talking to him because he and I were both in Bordeaux, same time, same week in September. I was there to film The Harvest and the scene, and he was there with a group of Somms that he had handpicked to sort of reintroduce Bordeaux to a younger generation. So to that end specifically, like the youngest Somme he was with was 25. I forget her name. She works for Mark Forgione here in the city. And the oldest Somme was like 32. So all of them were in their late 20s. And I remember seeing him, what the fuck? Where are they coming from? How are they so young and so smart? And I guess part of it is you're really young and your memories are great because your brain's still growing until you're 25. I'm like, mine, which is like, mine's like a little floppy disk that someone spilled coffee on, or Negronis, to be honest with you, at this point.
Negronis.
Yeah, a Negroni-soaked floppy disk. Oh. That's a good way for me to describe my mental state. But it's amazing. So you tell me your story. Mm-hmm. So you're billed as, and we're not going to go on the record of being the 100% sure, but one of the youngest accredited Somms from the American Sommelier Association.
Mm.
When you did this, you achieved this at the age of...
So I studied with the American Sommelier Association when I was 21 and was certified as a sommelier with the Court of Masters when I was 21 as well.
21?
21.
Which is the legal drinking age in most states.
In most.
What's the legal drinking age in New York?
21, yeah.
So you were cheating. You were drinking before you were drinking wine before you turned 21.
Well,
at home.
What?
With the permission of a parent.
And, you know,
I don't want to get you in trouble here. I don't know what the statute of limitations is. I don't want, like, the cops to come around. I saw some cops outside when I came in. There's definitely cops here in Bushwick.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, people always forget that there's a lot to do before you even pick up a glass of wine. You should study books. You should work a harvest. You should be a cellar hand. So all of that you have to get out of the way before you even pick up a glass of wine.
So you did all of that stuff?
Before I was 21, yeah.
What got you into, I mean... Everyone must ask you the same questions. This is probably a horrible interview. But I'm going to ask him because it just seems natural.
Go for it.
What got you into wine? Now, before we went on, Mike, you told me you moved around a bit. You lived in D.C. Mm-hmm. And then Jersey and then Manhattan and then blah, blah, blah. But what was it as a precocious late teen where everyone else is worried about God knows what? I don't know. You know, who's dating who and what's the latest feed on my social, whatever that shit's called. So what got you into wine?
Well, you know, I've always worked in restaurants, started when I was 13, and it was kind of a natural progression. I went to school, and eventually I found that I was spending more time studying wine and spending time with the sommeliers and in that part of the industry, and I was sort of drawn to it, and it was down the rabbit's hole from there.
So, all right, now we're gonna go... So at 18, what were you doing? You were out of high school at 18?
Out of high school at 17.
So at 18. So 18 put you in college or you...
18 put me in college. I went to Fordham University.
So you're up in the Bronx.
Lincoln Center, actually.
Oh, that's right. They have a campus downtown. Down here.
Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, I had been in the restaurant industry and I was usually a server, waitress. Right. And then when I turned 18, I started bartending at a little tiny restaurant on Restaurant Row. Italian place, and the owner, he was like, you don't know anything about wine. This is really embarrassing. You know, you're great with the guests, you love hospitality, but I mean, you don't know the difference between Cabernet and Merlot. It's embarrassing. And he suggested that I start reading, and so, you know, one book led to another book, and eventually I found a position as a cellar hand down at Harry's at Hanover Square.
Which is an amazing, I mean, that guy's a legend. And talk about deep cellars.
Yeah, it's like eight stories.
It's crazy. And it's funny you mention him because, again, Patrick was on a few weeks ago and Patrick was telling me that he, when people come into him out of town, he's good friends with Harry. He likes to take people down there because it's just such an epically cool place. It's so New York. And then Harry at one point brought out some, you know, bottle of Pommard or something, just, you know, like a first growth Burgundy, an old one, and opened it up and said, you know, because I was saying this to Patrick, that when I was a chef in the 80s, that's all wine lists were, was Burgundy, Bordeaux, and Champagne.
Right.
I mean, Italy really wasn't represented.
Right.
California kind of was, but it was still kind of an outlier even then. And they were affordable. So I remember even on, like, chef's pay, like, I could go out to Sherry Lehman and buy, like, a case of First Growth Bordeaux or Burgundy, and they cost, like, $20-some a bottle. And he put this bottle of Pommard and opened it up, and he said, Pat, you know, this bottle cost me, like, $5 in 1960-something. And, you know, it's worth, like, $2,000. It's like, what the F? So
yeah, he's great. He remembers exactly how much he spent on every single bottle of wine.
So this is true.
This is true, I'll tell you.
That's why he's good. So you ended up down there.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have been, like, crack.
It was amazing because I was able to, you know, I was reading about all these different wines and I was able to see the labels and the bottles and learn about the producers and hear stories from Harry.
You must have been tasting. Come on. When did you start tasting wine? Because I don't want to hear about, like, oh, I'm reading about Cabernet Sauvignon. Oh my God, this is so fat. Wouldn't that make you just want to just go grab a bottle and open it?
You know, their wines were tasted.
I mean, it has to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can't, I don't think really, I mean, it's not an intellectual exercise. It's very much an olfactory. I mean, you need, for what you're doing, you need the brain part, which I don't have. But the olfactory part, I've got down.
Of course.
So that's fine. So you're 18 years old, you're down at Harry's, 19 years old with this insane cellar.
Right. And, you know, it was a natural progression from there. And then, you know, turned 21, took all these exams, and then started working at Oriole as a sommelier.
Talk about that protocol, because this is, on this show, we've had Pascaline Lepeltier. Mm-hmm. One of my earliest restaurant friends was Roger Dagor. And I don't know if you know Roger, but he's like the Yoda of the Somm world.
Yes.
And he was on the floor when I was a sous chef at the Maurice.
Mm-hmm.
So I know about the Master Somm thing and how that works, but tell me about what you were doing. So how many courses, what's the study, what's involved?
Well, to prepare for the introductory exam, I took courses with the American Sommelier Association under Andrew Bell. So I took their 24-week viticulture and vinification course and then their 16-week blind tasting course. At the same time, I was taking the Quartermaster Sommelier exams. And right after I took the introductory course and passed, I signed up for the certified and took that as well and passed.
Who paid for that?
I was working a lot, so it was
you.
It was all me.
Go girl. So So at the age of 21, you pass this thing, which makes you, as far as we're concerned, the youngest one, because that's crazy. I mean, most people just don't have the knowledge or the breadth of experience or the interest, really, at that age to go through that kind of rigor.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just, you know, more is not enough, so I always, you know, push myself.
So then you get hot. So how did, I mean, I know Charlie, and this is the old Oriole or the new one on off Bryant Park?
New one.
The new one. Mm-hmm. It's that great space with this really kind of, I mean, Charlie's got a deep cellar. He's been in this business for a long, long time.
Yeah.
What was that like? I mean, that must have been amazing, huh?
It was amazing. When I had my interview with Justin Lorenz, who is the beverage director there at the time, he's such an amazing human, and he never actually asked me how old I was. And I'm sure there were tons of people that were way more qualified than I was for that position, but I think he knew that there was probably no one that would work harder than I would. And I worked a lot, and I learned a lot. And, tasting those wines and having those experiences in that cellar was definitely incomparable.
Yeah, so back to Patrick again. I mean, he talked about working his first job, I think, in New York was Tribeca Grill, which I didn't know, but Drew had a party, and Patrick was there, and I'm like, you worked here? My first job, dude. And so his first couple of jobs, he wasn't doing any wine buying, but he was like the assistant and just tasting, taking notes.
Yeah.
And then, then you end up at like Veritas and Gilt with these just like, Veritas was an excuse. It was a wine list with a restaurant as an excuse, as far as I'm concerned. And who was the, what was the other one on Fifth Ave? Was the same kind of list. That place was crazy too.
Montrachet?
No, yeah. Montrachet's great. No, I don't worry about it. So tell me about the restaurant Piora. So tell me about this. It's not Peoria. It's Piora. What's the name
it's
mean?
Piora. So Piora means to blossom. The owner's Korean, Simon Kim, and he wanted to create a space in which, all of the elements of the restaurant can really blossom. So we have a wonderful chef, Chris, who puts together these really well-constructed Italian-driven dishes, and then my job as the wine director is to pick really cool, interesting, approachable wines that can, complement the space, the restaurant, the experience, and the food ultimately.
And not just Italian wines.
Not just Italian wines.
Because I kind of peeked at some of the list and some of the stuff that you've been putting on the list. So tell me about some of that, like that, what's that Swiss white Chasselas?
Chasselas.
What? So you're such a schmuck. So the first time, and I'm like a million years old, the first time I probably had that wine in Switzerland, because I've been to Switzerland a lot, and we used to drink, we'd go mountain climbing and just drink like cases of wine every night. So I'm guessing that I had it and just didn't know what it was. But the only time I had it, the first time I had it and I knew what it was at Racine. Oh. So they poured it for me one night, and it was a blind tasting, and I had no idea what I was trying to didn't know what it was. So I'm like, what is this? I mean, I kind of got the weight, and it's high, the ripeness, the style. It's stainless. It's not oak. It's light. There's acid. It's high. The usual stuff you staring in a glass, swirling, sniffing. But after that, blank question mark.
Exactly.
And then he told me, I'm like, a what? So tell me about this wine.
So I really love Swiss wines. I think they're really great with food and very versatile. And Chasselas in particular, it's just this really beautiful, pure expression. It's like fresh spring water, mineral water. It's low in alcohol, really bright acidity. It's just one of those wines that you just can't stop drinking.
And low alcohol, so you don't have to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the whole bottle.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's kind of like what we do. What else in Swiss viticulture is something we don't know much about, and because you don't think of the Swiss and wine, you think of the Swiss and cheese or money laundering or
cheese,
something.
Cheese chocolate,
cheese chocolate, and
right,
a very funny culture. You've been to Switzerland?
I have, that's why I fell in love with the wines.
Yeah, but it's a strange place. The Swiss are Swiss. It's very
they're very strange.
It is. I mean, they're really kind of very buttoned up, and for that part of Europe, I mean, they're between France and Italy, and they're like.
You would think.
Yeah, but they're not like either culture that they're surrounded by. So what else from Switzerland?
So that's the thing. Like,
are they doing any reds?
They're doing some reds, yeah. One of my favorites is Cornelin. Super delicious. It's kind of this love child of Syrah, Dolcetto. It's, it's inky, but it has this really beautiful fresh fruit, some smokiness.
How do you spell that?
Cornelin. 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 Cave Calloz is one of my favorite producers, but you also have some delicious ones that are produced not only in Switzerland, but in the Val d'Aoste. In Italy. So it's kind of a fun little grape, and, it's the price point's always right, so that's delicious as well.
So it's no oak, all stainless, super food friendly, super light. Kind of like the weight, like Schiava, Grignolino, Nerella Mascalese.
Exactly. For the most part, it's like that rustic style. You know, there's not too much getting in the way. It's just really a pure fruit expression. And, you know, it, especially where it's grown in like the Valais and the French side, it's sunny. It's kind of like Alsace. So you get this really beautiful ripeness.
Speaking of Alsace, you have Alsatian wines on the list? I mean, you must. Some Rieslings?
We have a couple. It's not our specialty per se, but some delicious ones.
Is there a specialty per se on the wine list? Is like an area you've honed in on that you just can't get enough of it?
I mean, I've just started there a few months ago, so we're trying to develop
the
list.
That's right. You're new-ish. Right.
But, you know, Champagne, Rhone, Burgundy, and I've started to expand a little bit northern Italy because that's where a lot of my family has their roots, and, of course, Switzerland.
Yeah, I've been to the Alto Adige a couple of times. Just, I mean, super cool wine region, super great wines. Yeah. So you were at Oriole how many years?
I was at Oriole from 2011 until 2013.
And then?
And then I worked with Michael White in the Alta Maria group, so.
Which is great.
Great, yeah.
So by then, Risto was on the team.
Risto was on the team.
So he's like the top dog guy, the beverage director, I think is his title.
Head honcho, if you
will. But you were at Moreo, which is really their, I think, the point of the sword. That's just such an amazing restaurant.
Such an amazing restaurant.
Beautiful space. Beautiful. Insane food. And just a fantastic wine program to go with the food.
Absolutely. Francesco Grosso just does such a good job with the wine list there. It's amazing. And, you know, that fusilli, that octopus pasta, I could eat that for days. Michael White's so talented.
I could pretty much eat anything Michael White makes for days. The trouble is, you'll be getting a new wardrobe.
Yeah, that's probably
on a routine basis at the big and tall store that isn't really for tall people.
Yeah.
So what's a day like for you, a day in the life of Vassan? Because we're at this point in the city, I think, where everyone talks about it and everybody agrees, so it's not like a debatable thing, that there's never been a better time to be a wine lover in New York than today.
Yeah.
The wines that are coming here are extraordinary. The breadth and variety is unparalleled. I mean, people come from Europe, people come from France, and they'll sit down, they'll go to Racine, or go to someone, like, how do you get this? I can't get this. And I'm in Paris. How do you get this here?
Right.
So, I mean, you must limit your... Because you're constantly, I mean, you're a restaurant that has a profile, so you must have wine salespeople just constantly wanting to come over and taste with you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, all the time.
Right, because that's, I mean, you're laughing, but that's, right. No. So, but you have to say no, because that isn't what you have to spend all day doing. So what do you do? Try to pick a day or two a week where you let people come in, or a certain time of the day, every day? Or how do you do that?
Well, you know, I try to say yes as much as possible because I love to taste. And I really appreciate, you know, everything the wine salesman offers and brings to the table. So usually what I try to do is in the beginning of my week is when I try to taste the most and sort of plan out the rest of the month and the buying in our inventory. So that usually works well. But, you know, unfortunately, there's just only so many hours in the day.
Right, right. I know, because I hear Risto will just randomly post up on Facebook, like, what his day's like, and I'm like, you bastard. So much fun. But this is what you guys get to do. Now, so I know Lovie Dalton had that thing in Eater that I did not read, unfortunately, but he's such a smart, smart, smart guy, and kind of that Capiello generation of intermediate Psalms before it all blew up to where you are. What do you think about that? Is there going to be a... I mean, historically, so I go back to the, say, 80s, 90s, those two decades... In all of New York City, I don't think there were six restaurants with Psalms on the floor. There just weren't. It just wasn't a job title. No one, it just, there wasn't the interest. There wasn't the money. You trained your servers to do this stuff or whatever. And then in the aughts, somehow, it just began to go tick, tick, tick. And now the volume's at like 11, where you can't be taken seriously as a restaurant without a great beverage program, a dope wine list, and probably a Psalm. Is there going to be like an oversaturation point? Because you're on that, you're like the millennial gen. You're not even then. You're like younger, whatever you guys call yourself. What do you guys call yourself?
I don't think we have a name yet. We can come up with one if you'd like.
Okay. Well, we'll think about that.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, is there a talk among your Psalm friends? Is there like skittishness about this? Are there going to be ever too many of you? Or what? Or is the tide just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger?
Well, you know, it's hard to say and it's hard to predict, but there is definitely, you know, every restaurant now has multiple sommeliers, or a ton, and there definitely is a challenge in order to find work as a sommelier, and not only that, but an ideal job and an ideal situation. But, you know, competition's always good, and it's always good for the industry to a certain extent. And as long as people love what they do and there is that authenticity, I think that there will always be work for that sommelier. And then, you know, the people that, you know, don't give their all, you know, unfortunately, maybe there won't be jobs for them, but that's not the worst thing either.
Yeah, and you, I mean, clearly you've had like an, I mean, Harry's real Michael White, and now you're the som on the floor of a great restaurant in the West Village. Yeah. I mean, it's a hell of a run for a kid that's not a quarter of a century old yet.
Yeah, well, you know.
Good for you. Do you do anything with natural wines on your list? Are you sort of getting into that space? What's your take on the natural wine movement?
You know, I don't think... I've kind of gone back and forth. I think some people are in the camp that natural wine is lazy winemaking or the enemy, and then some people are in the camp that natural wine is the end-all be-all. And I think I'm kind of in the middle. If the wine's good, the wine's good. I don't think I will buy a wine for my list just because they're using native yeast, for example. There are a lot of producers that I respect that have been using this sort of method of just kind of hands-off for centuries and centuries, and there's a reason it works. But to that extent, I think that you can't be swayed just because something is trendy. So I think that's the only cautious thing that we should be... that we should keep in mind.
And it is trendy. And it has become kind of polarizing.
Right. Because
there's this one camp on this one side of the fence of the natural wine people who are just like F-U-ing anything at all. Like you can't spray, you can't use sulfur at any point, even including at the end for bottling. You know, blah, blah, blah. And then there's, you know, the people that are like, natural wine's like fucking science experiment gone wrong. Like, what is this shit?
I know. I mean, I don't want my wine to be gross. And I think that, you know, I mean, it has to be delicious. So
yeah, I'm with you. I think at the end of the day, that's where it has to speak to you.
Yeah.
Because it's funny. I mean, I'm trying to be, because I'm old. And so, but then when I think about like the whole, when you think about like the history of wine.
Right.
Like, you know, I mean, there's still great producers in Burgundy. I mean, the idea of using fertilizers in the soil and chemicals really was the middle of the last century.
Right.
Up until then, nobody was doing it.
Yeah.
And there's still guys in Burgundy where they say it's impossible that are just completely organic and bio.
But they also didn't, you know, ship their wines and, you know, send them that far. And now that they're traveling, you know, they're just unstable sometimes. So I think you have to keep that in mind.
Yeah, no, trust me. You know 10 Bells? You ever go to 10 Bells? You know,
yeah, of course.
I mean, I've gone there and they've poured some stuff for you. I'm like, is this supposed to be pleasant? Like, the nose on this wine, goat's ass? Like, how am I supposed to drink
this?
Why
would I like
this? This pairs with what?
Nothing.
Like a wet sock or something? Or...
But that's the thing. I think that's also why I'm so drawn to, like, Swiss wines, because they're just so clean and fresh, and there is sort of that, you know, everyone likes these Jura wines, and they can be wonderful, absolutely, but, you know, just next door in the Savoie or in Switzerland, you have, you know, this antithesis, like, you know, wines that you want with food. So
yeah, that's so funny. Savoie, that's so funny. That's we should talk about that. You have to go back to the restaurant. Thanks for coming out today. Pleasure to meet you.
Please stop by Pura.
What's the address of the restaurant? You're on Hudson, just north of
Leroy. We're on Hudson Street, 430 Hudson Street,
just north of
the West
Leroy.
Village.
Mm-hmm. Just north of Leroy, right near the Clam, which is another great little restaurant.
It is.
Victoria James, the youngest sommelier, 21 years old. Now she's 25. Holy mackerel! You're so good, so smart. Keep it up. It's so great to meet kids
like you
because it's just like you. As I have said, this is like a new species walking the planet Earth. The 25-year-old, like, som genius. I'm like, what?
Oh, goodness, that's funny.
How'd that happen? Thanks for coming
out. Thank
you. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to have a quick shout-out to run a couple spots where people support this show. And then we're going to have Siri Kawano come out, who is the founder, president of Korin, K-O-R-I-N, which is the legendary... it's the go-to store in New York City if you're looking for anything in the space of Japanese knives, Japanese restaurant equipment, all that stuff. We're going to talk about her history, about this, the history of Korin, in about 3 minutes after this spot, so stay tuned. Folks, Mike Halameko here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Cola Vida family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vida family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vida. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriters, and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Cola Vida family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Cola Vidas living in Rome, Cola Vidas living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I recommend you try it as well. So if you listen to the show, you know I am a wine lover. We get sommeliers here all the time. We get winemakers. I've been drinking wine with dinner since before most of you were born. And when you think of the great wine regions of the world, I mean, what comes to mind? Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, Piedmont? Yeah, okay. Well, I just got back from Bordeaux. Was there for the crush for the 2015 harvest. And I was thrilled to see, A, how the city of Bordeaux has transformed itself. It's so alive. It's so beautiful. And the region itself is crazy. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons were coming in, and they're not making your grandfather's Bordeaux anymore. Young farmers, young vignerons that have been there for generations, that know the soil, that know the grapes. And what grapes are we talking about? You know, we're pretty familiar here. Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec, all of those grapes find themselves in these blends. But the new style of Bordeaux wines are super fresh, super young, super clean, meant to be consumed now, not cellared for decades, because really, who has a cellar? The whites are super great. I think they're super undervalued and appreciated. Semillon, Sauvignon Blanc, crisp, dry, all stainless. If there's a little oak integration, you barely feel it. And the reds come in all sorts of styles. You know, the left bank is a little more Cabernet Sauvignon heavy, a little more structured, a little more tannic. The right bank with more Merlot tends to be fruity, a little more opened up, receives you a little bit easier. But if you've been walking past that Bordeaux aisle in your wine store, stop and grab a bottle. From $15 to $35 is some of the best value on planet Earth. With wines that are growing in one of the great wine regions, vignerons that are passionate, they know what they're doing. Give Bordeaux a second shot. I love the wines. I believe we're back live. Thank you, thank you. So welcome back, everybody. Privileged to have Siri Kawano, who is, among other things, the founder and president of Korin, K-O-R-I-N. And I'll never forget my first job in New York City, 1982. Got here in January. Out of the Culinary Institute, loaded up my Ford Maverick or Pinto, whatever it was, and came down here in a blizzard, got my first apartment, and the first job was at the Four Seasons restaurant under Seppi Rankley and Hitch when Covey and Margatai were the owners. And Alex and Julian were there even then, so it's amazing how little's changed. Anyway, but it was funny. So I'm brand new to New York, so I don't know what to expect. I don't know what the normal is because I'm a kid from Philly. And the kitchen's astonishing. I mean, Seppi was a genius. He was a Swiss chef, and he was a brilliant guy to work near and just observe and watch how he could sort of intuit recipes. His lunch special every day for the grill room was always something fantastic. But for some reason, about a third of our kitchen were Japanese guys who English wasn't great. I don't know why the Four Seasons attracted them. I don't know why that kitchen. And that's the first time I'd ever seen Japanese knives. And I'll never forget, again, every morning they would come in, pull out those big stones, wet stones, water stones, yes. And they'd sharpen their knives. And then Seppi would have them. They would be like, they would do like the garniture for some of his specials. And they were doing that daikon thing where you hold a daikon and create like paper thin toilet paper out of a daikon. And I'm like, what? And I was watching him turn like, just, I'd never seen this stuff before. And I remember the first time I picked up those knives. I was like, God, they're really light. They're really interesting stylistically. It's black steel. It's totally different than we were all using these 12-inch Solingen German, you know, hatchets, basically, and trying to keep them sharp as we could on tri-stones. But and so I remember, like, discovering your store in the early 80s. And by then, by the late 80s, it wasn't unusual for American kids working in New York kitchens to have part of their knife kit be Japanese knives. So what brought you into the – did you start the business just thinking you were going to be supporting the Japanese community culinary community in New York City when Corinne started?
How I started Corinne was just from my necessity. I have to find a way to make living in New York City without speaking much English and no knowledge about anything. And all I knew was about the Japanese restaurants because I worked for the Japanese restaurant for my make living. I was school teacher in Japan. Mm. And from this tiny experience, I thought, introducing the Japanese product to the restaurant will be the only way of surviving in New York City. And the knives, everyone, all the cooks and chefs are using knives. Why not introducing knives to American chefs? Right. That's how I came to this.
And in 1982, you opened just with a leap of faith.
Yes. And back then, no one knew about the Japanese knives, benefit and the specialty. I had a really hard time to introduce Japanese knives, and I started giving away to the American chefs. And when I gave away for free, everyone said, oh, this is a great knife. But when I started charging, they all complained, this is too light. Too delicate. I didn't cut anything hard one, but it's chipped. So this is a defective. This is really no good. I want my money back. Refund me. Right. Or please replace with a new one.
Right, so because if it has a lifetime guarantee. Right.
I was poor, but I got more poor by these complaints. But then that was a really good turning point. I thought, maybe I should introduce Japanese culture, how the Japanese chefs has been using Japanese knives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, fast forward to today, because I mean, the 80s, it's so funny when I think of New York, when I got here in 82, I mean, the sushi restaurants were pretty much 90% for Japanese expats. There weren't a lot of Americans walking in.
No.
So it was Saito and Hatsuhana.
You know very well.
The old ones. But then they were all on the east side, kind of near the UN, because that was a lot of the customers.
Yes.
And so we'll fast forward to today. And there's a book that just came out, Chef's Choice, which you're one of the authors of. And when I think of, I mean, David Boulay is like the perfect poster boy. I mean, he's such a chef. He's such an amazing.
Yes.
I don't want to talk about David as a businessman because that's a whole other discussion. And it's not a good one. But there's no, his culinary credentials are unimpeachable. And anyone that's ever worked with him, worked side by side with him in the kitchen, just knows he's about one thing only. It's about perfection in that kitchen. And huge follower of Japanese food, Japanese culture, Japanese cooking, Japanese ingredients.
Yes.
Michael Anthony, Gramercy Tavern.
Yes.
I mean, same story. I think he talks to me about like going back to Japan and having it be this epiphany. So tell me about this book that you put together.
Yes. Why I wrote The Chef's Choice is because through Corinne's business, those chefs came to Corinne's store and I visited their restaurants and I knew they have an influence by Japanese food culture and they had an impact through their pathway. And so all of these stories are so fascinating and so touching. And it was too good to keep just by myself. I wanted to share this really amazing inspiration with many more people.
Because again, I know that so you take someone like Michael Romano, right? So Michael came up through Union Square Hospitality Group. He was a chef at Union Square Cafe for many, many years.
Yes.
Italian-American, Italian name. Yes. Always had a big pasta program. And then at some point, it was like Michael had this, like, it's like a bad analogy, but, you know, like a cross-dresser. So suddenly you discover, like, he's got this whole other side to him where he's completely head over heels in love with Japanese food.
Yes.
And I never knew that about Michael. Like, he's really a proponent of Japanese cuisine.
Yeah, I thought his past life is Japanese.
Correct. Right, it's crazy, right?
Crazy.
Yeah, how? Because he's like, what is he up to these days? Do you know?
He's semi-retired in the U.S., and he's keep going back to Japan.
All the time. Yeah. So who else did you work with in New York City with this? Marcus Samuelson, I see.
Yeah. When we put this book together, we asked chefs who have experience with Japanese food products and are customers and friends of Sari-san to share some of the stories that they had with us and about the influences that they've used in their restaurants and in their own training and how they train others over the years. And so what we've done is we asked several of these people to sit down with us for a couple hours, and we asked them all similar questions about influences, ingredients, their career paths, how they train others and how they were trained themselves, and then how they create their cuisine, and then a day in the life. And through these interviews, would last at least a couple hours, we condensed them into a narrative so that they're telling their story in their words, really how that Japanese culture really played into theirs. And some of those chefs are Japanese, some are French, some right. are American, but they all share this attitude and approach to food that I think really stems from that Japanese culture training.
We'll go back to David, because I think David's just a great example as a chef. What was his story? What drew him into this, and what did you use in the book to describe it?
Yeah, he started teaching French at the very famous Tsuji Cooking School in Japan, and the exchanging of this, he learned Japanese cuisine, Japanese cooking, like making dashi, broth, and all these. And it's over 30 years of cooking exchange experiences, he got deeper and deeper. Now he became an ambassador of Japanese culture. He was chosen by Japanese government, the Japanese culture ambassador. And he is so passionate about health because he wants to introduce special ingredients of Japanese foods we've been using for century and century, like kuzu or yuzu. Mm-hmm. All these has a big benefit for people's health, like for diabetes or all these. And he's so into it.
He's very passionate about it. He tells a story, and he told us a story in his restaurant when we were chatting with him, how to kill a fish the Japanese way. And, of course, we're looking at him thinking, well, what's this all about? And he explained to us that part of the problem, the way fish are harvested traditionally here, that by the time the fish gets to the restaurant, it's lost a lot of flavor and its flesh is, decomposing to a certain degree. And he explained how he was trained to kill a fish, and then he tells the story about after the fish is pithed in the back, that it's put in a tub. The fishermen, on the boat, they put the fish in a tub of water to let the fish kind of still move around, kind of like the chicken without its head running around the farmyard, so that the muscles continue to contract. And what it does is it prevents the toxins from going into the muscles. So this is kind of a very, I don't know, a deep approach to, killing a fish. And so he was even saying that he would actually pay the fishermen more money to kill the fish this way and preserve their tact, so to speak, so that when they got to the restaurant, they would have more flavor. So he goes to a pretty deep level.
Yeah, but it's kind of, they talk about the same thing with animal husbandry and with the slaughtering of cows, slaughtering of pigs, is mm-hmm. if they're really stressed, which they are in commercial slaughterhouses,
that's right.
They know something's up, they don't want to be there, their bodies tense up, you're getting all sorts of stuff in that meat that's just a reaction from the blood. Yeah. And, if the more naturally you can take them down, oftentimes, I mean, chefs are just the better tasting the meat.
Yeah, I think the point that he made and that most of these chefs made, and one of the objectives when we wrote the book, is that we wanted to go deep, and we wanted to ask these chefs from all different restaurants and experiences, really going deep into why they do what they do, their approaches to cuisine, their approaches to food, and share that not just with student chefs, with professional chefs, mm-hmm. with culinary educators, with people who are in the hospitality industry, even home chefs like me. I'm not a professional chef. I'm a professional writer and speaker. But I found this book, working on this book, a true education. And that was part of our goal, is to get from these people the depth of knowledge that they really have to share.
And it's a great, I mean, was, just without going through list and list, but Michael Anthony, David Boulay, Wiley Dufresne, all here in New York, of course, Nobu, Eddie LaRue with Danielle, Ben Pollinger. I'm surprised Ben's in here, but Ben's in a seafood restaurant, so it's not so... What was Ben's comment? Because Ben's an interesting guy.
Yeah, Ben.
Eric Repair. I mean, it keeps going. Michael Romano. It's a great book. Yeah. Chef's Choice is the name of the book. What was Ben's comment? I'm just curious.
Ben has been a very big believer in the chef who showed interest in Japanese cuisine because he cooks fish, so he wanted to learn about cooking in Japanese way because the Japanese has been eating fish. So he attended all the lectures I provided as a Gohan Society non-profit organization who introduced Japanese food culture. And he went to Japan with me last year, and he really understood completely by going there and had an apprenticeship at the Japanese restaurant there, how to take care of the fish, how to cut and clean and everything, because he take care of the fish every day. So that's why he was interested in, and I thought that he's a perfect fit chef.
Yeah, and his, Ben, if you don't know, Ben Pollinger is a chef at Oceana, which is a great, one of the great seafood restaurants in the city, always has been. And they've got a gorgeous kitchen for seafood, too.
Yes.
I don't know if you've seen it. They get that.
Oh, yeah.
He built that custom, and the owners, the Ilvanov family. I mean, I don't know. I was joking, like, how'd you convince them to give you this much space? Because it's a two-story kitchen. The main kitchen's huge. And then downstairs, the fish butchering area is just perfect. And it's tile. It's drain. There's a hose for scaling. It's like a chef's delight.
Yeah. Ben tells a great story in the transition between those two restaurants, the early Oceana and the present one.
Oh, the early one was a dump. The early one sucked. The early one, the roof leaked. I remember the kitchen. I remember all the chefs that were through there.
He apparently came in one day, and a couple of the chefs were having a bit of a tiff, and one of the chefs just walked out, and one of his wine chefs. And Ben just took charge and got on the line and was just cooking along with everybody else, you know, for hours and hours and hours. And I think he, as he's telling the story in the book, that at the end of that service, that was the largest service they had ever had in the restaurant. So, again, part of the stories are about food. Part of the stories are about what it takes to succeed in this business. And I have to tell you, you know, having sort of a fantasy, oh, wouldn't it be fun to have a restaurant?
No, the answer is no.
It's far too hard. But I tell you, the amount of respect that I think other readers will find in reading some of these stories is really quite amazing, that what they do and how they have gone about doing it. And that's something else that came out of the book, the lessons, just not about cooking and not just about the restaurant business, but about how to succeed in general. That's really a lot of the subtext of the book, is these people are folks that just do not stop in their pursuit of success. And it's in.
Yeah, I see all the great chefs I know. I mean, there's that piece that Gordonier did about Daniel Hum, and then that whole Kitchen 11 Madison. Bryce at Bettany. I loved what Bryce was doing 2 years ago. I went there. I hadn't been there for a couple of years. For really, we're doing completely different things now. They're relentlessly moving forward. It's never good enough. Yeah. They never sit on anything.
Yeah, and this is a good message for people. Everybody, I think, not just the chefs, not just student chefs or other professional chefs. It's a good message for anyone.
So Amazon?
Amazon.
Yes, Amazon.
Okay. Name of the book is Chef's Choice, 22 Culinary Masters, Tell Japanese Food Influence Their Careers in Cuisine. Siri Kawano, Don Gaber, thanks so much for coming in. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay
Mike.
Tuned. We're going to go back to wine. We're going to segue from France to from Japan to France, or something like that. We've got Michael Madrigal, who is Danielle Boulud's Psalm at Barbaloud. So stay tuned for that in just a minute. Thank you. Okay, we're back. On that note, Michael Madrigal is my guest. You've been out here before. Michael is the beverage director, sommelier for Boulousoute and Barbaloute, or just Barbaloute?
Both. Like Floorsom.
Floorsom.
Wine director, Floorsom. You know, I'm a som that still works the floor.
Which, you mean there's people that don't have to do that?
You
mean like... As opposed to...
Well, you know, I've been working for Danielle for 8 years.
Right, Dynex.
Dynex.
Incredible.
And... you know, usually there's an arc in the career of a sommelier where you work the floor, you get tired of it, you say, you know what, I want to be the guy who just sits in the office and buys wine and, you know, don't have to work the floor anymore. And I never had that desire to leave the floor. You know, if I'm going to be a somm, I'm going to be on the floor because I like being on the floor. And I think if you are a sommelier, that's what you do.
Yeah, I would have thought. I mean, they do it. It is part of the... It's part of the drill,
and
it's part
kind
of sort of the magic as a customer to have. You have great staff. I mean, we'll talk about that in a second because I love how you train your staff. But you know, have the somm come and just that sense of comfort you get. Okay, this is the guy or the lady who knows the list, who knows the food. Because I'm always, I mean, my advice to everybody eating out is if there's a somm on the floor or someone that is the wine spokesperson, let them do the pairings. Why would you want to try yourself?
Right.
They know the food. They know the wine list. They know what works. Why would you roll dice on gamble?
Right. And the good ones, you know, it's that thing like if you trust me enough to do you right, I'm going to do you right.
Right.
And I'm going to make sure that I'm going to make your head spin. And that's the great thing because in hospitality, you know, you want to make people happy.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're really good at what you do, that is what you wake up with every day. You know, if you go in and do the job, you want to do the right thing and you want people to leave so happy, so excited with very good memories of what, you know, the 2 hours that they spent with you. So when you do that, when you give them the opportunity to impress and to make your meal great, I don't think it's taken lightly. It's something that we want to rise to the occasion.
And you do that. I mean, Daniel Boulousoute, he's a quintessential pro. I can never heap enough praise on Daniel. He has been a mentor to so many, at this point, generations.
Yeah.
And I remember when Daniel first came here. I think he came up from D.C. It had to do with Jean-Louis Paladin.
Right.
And this was back when chefs weren't making a lot of money. Right. There was no TV network. It was a bloody job. And he was like a lot of French guys, like my old boss, Christian Delouvrier. Uh-huh. I mean, these guys were executive chefs at hotels, and they were making, like, you know, in the early 80s, like 40-some thousand.
Right.
It wasn't a lot of money.
Right.
And they were, you know, kicking the and you know, Danielle just got that break at Le Cirque, blew up, got the 4 stars. But he has just been such a great guy, and I think nobody like the other great ones. He gets the hospitality thing. So you're part of your staff training at both places. But we'll talk about Barbaloute. I know is classic because you've got. Is it once a week you do tastings? Is it Thursdays?
Yeah, we just did it yesterday, Wednesday.
Wednesdays.
Yeah, when you sat in with us.
Well, this happened to be, we were filming one day.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm a so sucker. Like, when I, like, my somm friends that hang out with me, or no, I love, just for the exercise, to be blind tasted wherever I go. Just like, don't tell me what I'm drinking, pour me a glass, come back in 10 minutes, here's what I'm thinking, am I close? And, you know, 95% of the time you're... close, but that's not it. Or you know, it's because it's really hard. I mean, I mean, we're not all Pascaline, right? But you do a thing where you have an a distributor.
Yep.
Comes in on Wednesdays.
Yeah, you know, it's as a buyer, you get inundated with people trying to sell you wine.
Correct.
And then if you're really worth your salt as a head sommelier wine director, you're educating the staff. So I just figured, okay, if I have all these people trying to sell me wine and I want to really teach people about wine who work here, from, you know, the Bengali food runner to the, you know, the Oaxacan dishwasher to the servers and sommeliers, why don't I kill two birds with one stone and have these reps who want to show me wine show all of us the wine and come in and wrap them in aluminum foil so I don't know what they are, none of us know what they are, and present, give us an hour of your time, bring in maximum 8 wines, number them 1 to 10, and pour them for me and for the dishwasher and for my other somm team and for the bartender and the chef sometimes if he isn't work, you know, if he isn't doing you know, some sort of prep at the moment. Let's just taste the wine together. And that's what I do. And I kind of like corral the tasting. I don't want to insert myself so much that I'm pontificating the entire time.
You were. I was there for one of these, so I can't speak to everyone, but I'm sure what I saw was what happens every time. Yeah. You were actually kind of in the periphery. You were like in the outfield somewhere.
Yeah.
And I must say, so I'm just like, there's wine tasting. I want to be in this. We'll stop. Guys, you go do B-roll.
Right.
I'm going to do this tasting because I'm a sucker for that shit. And yeah, it was like, yeah, you were getting like these kind of darker skinned Bangladeshi runners and everybody's got an opinion. No, I think this is something. I think this is a Gunnarsvelten. I'm not sure I'm getting it. Right. And everyone, like nobody was because it's kind of, it's a little scary to be the first person to put your hand up in a blind tasting.
Of course.
Because if you didn't get it right, and if you're really wrong, you feel like an idiot. You kind of, I don't want to do that again.
Right.
You know, if you're mistaking Alsatian Rieslings with California over-oak Chardonnays, there's a problem, folks.
For sure.
So it's really, nobody kind of wants it, but everybody there was like, couldn't wait to jump in. Right. Everybody had opinions.
Right, and I think the way that I started it is that, okay, I always give the floor up to anybody who really feels they know what the wine is or they want to talk about it. And if no one speaks, then I'll be the first one to speak. I never want to be the only, you know, the first one. So then I can go over the ridge and take the arrows if I'm wrong. And once I'm wrong and they see that I'm comfortable with being wrong and I'm not always right when I'm blind tasting, then it makes everyone a bit more comfortable. Then they're saying, okay, I can really tell you exactly what I feel that this wine is. Because I'm not afraid of being wrong. And I think with the world of wine and, you know, the sommelier or the wine director, there a lot of them are just, all they care about is just keeping their edge on everyone. And I'm the boss. And I will never put myself out there because I don't want to look like I'm wrong because I tell you what to do. And I've never had that attitude. And it's like, let's all do this together. And I, you know, I've tasted a lot of wine and, you know, I've been in the wine business for 16 years. So, you know what? I think maybe I'm okay with putting myself out there and seeing if, and taking a bet that I'm going to be right more often than I'm wrong. But if I'm wrong, you know, I'm wrong. And if the busboy is right and I'm wrong and that's happened before, then that's amazing.
Oh, cool.
And I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
Because you have a talent. You can pick up the wine without ever visiting there, with not really drinking because your religion doesn't allow you to drink alcohol, but you can pick out a wine from smelling it, which has happened before.
Just smelling it.
Like, yeah, I remember that's... one of the busboys were like, this is Chablis. I can tell. I know it. I smell it. I'm not going to drink it, but because they're servers, they really need to know and smell the wines and what they are. And one of the guys got it right.
That's great.
Yeah, and that's amazing for me.
Yeah, that's not like so Barbalude, you have this great program. I mean, you see it every day. Everyone that's your friends with on Facebook, you have the most hilarious posts where I don't know who takes those pictures or what kind of camera you are, but it's always
an iPhone.
That's what I was guessing. Yeah. I was talking to somebody about this earlier today. So it's a shot of a large format bottle against the window on facing Columbus Avenue.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's random people walking around. It's just funny because you time that shit too. And the comment will be like a pun based on the person's clothes or their t-shirt or the weather
or
the wine or all of the above combined.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you started there years ago was to do, I think it was just one night a week then, wasn't it?
No, it was always every night.
Every night you would feature until you ran out.
Yeah.
A really unusual, sometimes rare, we would say.
Usually, mostly, most of the time rare.
Most of the time rare.
Most of the time rare.
A lot of time first growths or close. Yeah. In a large format bottle from back vintages.
Yep.
And you're selling it by the glass, basically, I'm not going to say at cost.
Cost. Not much more than cost.
Not much more than cost.
Yeah.
To get people in.
Yeah, you know, I've told this before, I've said this before, but, you know, I love wine, and I'm still have that youthful joy when I taste wine. And I still remember myself when I was 24 or 25 and getting into wine and doing whatever I could to learn. And, you know, when Astor Wine and Spirits was at Astor Place, right? I remember going there and not having a ton of money, but wanted to learn about wine. And they always had that great half bottle section there. So I would go buy like four half bottles and then sit there with Wines for Dummies in my apartment when my roommates would be going out and just like tasting wine and trying to see the differences of the wines. And always thinking to myself, man, I wish I could try one of these wines with age, you know, 10 years old or 15 years old, because that was a thing that was never available because you couldn't really buy them in retail stores. Yeah. And that idea of having the opportunity to taste old wines is the greatest thing for learning, I think, if you want to learn about wine, to see where wine evolves and where it goes and what, you know, a Ridge Montebello tastes like 25 years old, something like that. And that 23-year-old vision of myself kind of is what pushed me to do this type of thing and to say, let's give everyone a chance to taste great wines with age, because the age thing is what really made this move. Because anybody can find wines through regular distribution, but the older wines is what's hard to get. And that was always the challenge for me.
And specifically, if we're talking Bordeaux, if we're talking Burgundy, if we're talking the California Bordeaux style, those wines were intentionally made and had been, up until relatively recently, including in Bordeaux, had been made to age.
Right.
I mean, they just, upon release, they weren't drinkable, and everybody knew, like, big Barolos, this one, if you don't sell this for 15, don't even open this for 15 years. Just, it'll start to open up in 10 to 15. It'll peak at somewhere between 25 and 50. It's crazy, right? That's how those wines were made.
Yeah, and the best guys still make it that way, in
still,
my opinion.
Yeah.
But that's what wine is for me. You know, tasting the old stuff, tasting, you know, it's like getting steak cooked at the perfect temperature. It's like catching that wine in the perfect moment.
Because there is this balance. I mean, that was the whole point of those age-worthy wines. That was the whole point of the Bordeaux blends, was to sort of, as the cellar master, here's how it's going to taste on release. Forget on premiere. Here's how it's going to taste on release when we decide we're done with barrique, we're done with letting it sit in the bottle, we're good. But his or her vision of it was 25 years later.
Yeah.
How's that as those tannins begin to soften up? Right. As will there still be fruit? And then you'll see. Who's America's first master sommelier? What's the chap's name?
Was that? Oh, yeah. He lives in California.
He lives in California. So he Facebook friended me. And I'm like, are you kidding me, dude? Like,
Eddie Osterlin.
I don't even know how Eddie Osterlin heard of me. Eddie, if you listen to this shit, thank you so much. Yeah. I get a Facebook friend from this guy, and I'm like, fuck. Is he looking for? There is no other Mike. This can't be a mistake. So then he had a recent birthday party. His wife took him to the French Laundry, and they had a Bordeaux from his birth year, which is like the late 40s. And the bottle is still great. And I remember it was like a Facebook picture of it sitting on the side decanter of the decanting of the bottle. And he said, and it's amazing how much fruit was still in this wine.
Right.
And you're talking about a wine that's plus 60 years old.
Right.
Right. So somewhere that cellar master who's probably dead, the man, the vigneron, it has a smile on his face.
For sure.
Right. That they can do that with wine.
Yeah. And that's why wine is, it's like, it is time travels. People have said that, and it's true.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you go visit these wineries, or especially in the old world, and if you're lucky enough to have a very, very old vintage from the people you go visit, and they'll open it up, and then the guy is opening up, and he's like, "My grandfather made this, and I can tell his personality when I taste this.
It's crazy.
I can talk. It's like I'm talking to him. Yeah. Like, where does that exist in anything else?
Doesn't. Really.
No, it doesn't exist.
It doesn't. I mean, maybe the written word or something. But
right,
know,
maybe
but
that, but then it's not as
it's
alive.
Not, it's, not, right, it's, right, it's not something that you're putting in a glass, putting it in your nose, and going, holy shit.
Right.
And then And even wines you don't think of that way. I took my son to he lives in the city. You got to meet him when he's become a total wine geek. He's gotten to meet Pascaline and had dinner with my Somme friends. And he's totally won't get his nose out of the glass. So all he and I will just sit and talk about wine for hours. And if you're not into wine, you're bored shitless. But anyway, so I took him to one of those Renegade wine dinners the other night at Pearl and Ash, which is another great wine program.
Sure.
Patrick's amazing what he's doing there. And it was all French, all different regions, depending on the course. It was, I think, six courses. We had about 20-some wines. And the couple we were sitting with at the table were just so – had so much fun listening to Sean and I, and actually all four of us, became one group, as it happens in New York, mm-hmm. that the guy said, you know, even though this thing's over, let me buy a bottle of wine. I said, you don't have to. I'll buy a bottle. So we went to the bar, ordered a bottle of wine, and it was a 78 Cab Franc from Loire.
Uh-huh.
And so it's an old wine. It's like 30.
Jogay or something like that.
It was a woman. I have it on my phone. I have it on my phone, a picture of it. It was a female producer, and it was just amazing.
Yeah.
And you don't think of those. I mean, not that Cab Franc doesn't age, but you don't think of Loire Valley as wines that are made for of that. So this is a mid-30-year-old bottle of wine, and it was just beautiful.
Right.
Fresh, crisp, alive, vibrant. Like, what the heck?
Yeah.
And still that green pepper on the nose that you get from Cab Franc,
sure.
that signature.
That's
like,
that cool climate.
That he poured it out, and as soon as I smelled it, I said, this is Cab Franc, right? And he says, yeah. And I said, let me see the bottle. Like, what the fuck? Yeah, it's incredible. Well, thanks so much for coming out. You know, we've got a... I thought you were going to be longer on the show today. I had a guest that I wasn't aware that I'd booked, so... Someone's like, oh, yeah, okay, come on in. Michael Madrigal is in charge of the wines for Beloud Sud, Barbeloud. Barbeloud, I love Barbeloud. I love Beloud Sud, too, but Barbeloud is has a place in my heart because I grew up in that generation sort of working with older French chefs, cooking a style of food that was a little more rustic.
Yeah.
And this is sort of Daniel's homage to Lyon, which is the poulet de Brest, the capital of charcuterie,
it's
of
French
butter.
Soul food.
French freaking soul food. Yeah. It's just so good. And that charcuterie program's been famous since day one.
Yeah.
The menu's great around it. The wine list is superb. And on any given night, thanks to you, you can have these ridiculous wines by the glass.
Yeah. We still have fun. That's what's great about
it. You seem like it. Thanks so much for coming out.
Sure, bud.
Happy New Year. Folks, stay tuned. Next week, I've got Chris Strzok coming. Chris is a Somme. Chris worked at Racine when I met him, and I don't think it's going to be any secret. He's pouring wine now at a couple different restaurants and Ten Bells, but I think when Rouge Tomat reopens, he's on the floor.
Is that right?
That's the story.
All
so
right.
I heard.
You heard it here first.
You heard it here first. Stay tuned for that and somebody else next week. I never know who I'd book. Stay tuned. We'll see you next week, folks. Thank you.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.